In 2 Samuel and chapter 16, we meet with King David at a very low point in his life. You may remember that in the previous chapters, David has been subject to a dreadful attack by his own son, by Absalom. Absalom conspired against his father by winning people over to himself. And then he arranged a secret rebellion that would result in him being pronounced king without having fought a single battle. Through charm, through personal marketing, through lies, Absalom managed to convince many people from across the tribes of Israel that he would make a better king than his father. And by the time of chapter 16, David has become sufficiently concerned about Absalom's power base that he evacuates Jerusalem and heads off to safety, whilst Absalom marches on the capital city. Now, as you can imagine, David must have been in deep distress to leave his beloved Jerusalem. It says that as he was proceeding up the Mount of Olives with all his retinue with him, he had his head covered in shame. He went barefoot and he was weeping as he went. This was a very solemn, a very sad occasion. And obviously what made the whole situation particularly bad was that fact that it was David's own son who was throwing him off the throne. Not a Philistine, not a disgruntled tribal baron from somewhere else. It was someone from David's own family who was acting against him. Someone whom David loved. Someone whom David had treated mercifully when Absalom had attacked, had killed his brother Amnon, taken the law into his own hands because of Amnon's rape. David ultimately brought Absalom back. He showed him mercy for that murder. And yet that son has turned against him. So at the start of chapter 16, we meet with David in a very, very sad and low state of mind, state of heart. But it's not just this rebellion that's caused it. It's worse than that. David knows why this trouble has risen up in the country. It's not just the attitude of Absalom that's caused it. David knows that it's his own conduct that's brought about this trouble. The rebellion, this outbreak of appalling violence within his own family, has come about because of David's own sins. Just a short while before, a matter of months maybe, that David had been lazily drifting around his palace, and from that flat roof he spied that attractive young woman. He ordered that she should be brought to him so he could sleep with her, but then she fell pregnant. And then David's problems got worse. She was married. Her husband was a loyal soldier fighting with the Israelite army. If it's discovered what David has done, it will be devastating. So he moves to hide the adultery. He tries one scheme after another. And then in the end, he has him bumped off. He has him killed. A man called Uriah loses his life because of David's sin. But God knew all that David had done. And God said he would punish him. And so David is fleeing the city, knowing that the trouble he is in, he's caused, he's brought upon himself. He's been driven out of his own city because of his sin with Bathsheba and his sin against Uriah. God had planned it all. But now in chapter 16, things are going to get worse. Two things happen in chapter 16. And those two things will just add to David's grief and his depression about these circumstances. What are the two things? Well, they are both almost like flashbacks to the past. They're both painful reminders of what happened in David's past, as well as being extra trials he has to bear in the present. What's going to happen is going to involve Benjamite people, people from the tribe of King Saul. First of all, we have the story of Mephibosheth. And in that story, David experiences painful disloyalty. What happens is this. In chapter 16, from verse 1 down to verse 4, a man called Ziba comes, and he finds David on his escape route out of Jerusalem. He brings with him many gifts. He is very well prepared to show his support for the troubled king. But Ziba is no ordinary person doing this. Ziba had once been the servant of King Saul. And after Saul's death, David appointed Ziba to serve a man called Mephibosheth. Now Mephibosheth was Saul's grandson. He was the son of Prince Jonathan. And Jonathan, as you may well remember, had been David's greatest and his finest friend. There was nobody closer to David than Jonathan. He had supported him even when Saul, Jonathan's father, had opposed David, had sought to kill him. Well, Ziba, who serves Mephibosheth, comes out to meet David with all these preparations, the donkeys and the food and the drink. But he comes alone. There's no Mephibosheth with him. Now David's surprised by this, and he asks Ziba what's going on. He says to him, "Where is your master's grandson? Why is the servant there with a line of donkeys, with supplies of goods? Why is the servant there without the master?" And this is Ziba's reply. He is staying in Jerusalem because he thinks, "Today, the house of Israel will give me back my grandfather's kingdom." Ziba tells David that Mephibosheth is sat there hoping that this rebellion, Absalom's rebellion, will turn out for his benefit. That he'll regain some of the power that's been lost by his family. That when Saul and Jonathan died and the throne transferred to David, now's a chance to recover it. Is the charge against Mephibosheth true? And the answer is, we don't know. You see, there's a complication in the whole matter, and it's this. Mephibosheth has been crippled, badly disabled, since he was 5 years old. He had a very nasty fall. And because of his disability, he cannot move around. He can't get to places easily without the help of others. He needs other people to get him there. So the fact is that he was a man who couldn't easily escape from Jerusalem. When the call came from David, when everybody said, "Right, let's go," Mephibosheth depended upon other people to help him do that. So maybe his absence can be explained in other ways. Maybe what Ziba's saying isn't true at all. Maybe he isn't disloyal. But as David listened to Ziba, he believed him on the spot. He took him at his word and he said to him, "Okay, then you have his property then. I transfer his land, his goods to you. If he is going to let me down, and you have come here with all this help, you have what was his." David on the spot decided to punish Mephibosheth for his disloyalty, for his rebellion. He stripped him of everything he owned and gave it to the servant. Now you can see in that, can't you? You can see in that sudden reaction from David just how David himself was feeling. Mephibosheth, think about it, owed a great debt to David. Back in chapter 9, the story is told of how David himself wanted to find somebody in Saul's household. He wanted to find somebody that he could treat with kindness. He wanted to do it for the sake of his friend Jonathan. And he was delighted when it was Jonathan's own son who was discovered, who reappeared on the scene. And David gave to Mephibosheth all the land that his grandfather Saul had owned. But he did more than that. He said to Mephibosheth, "And now I'll have you treated like a royal prince in my own household. You will come and eat at my table. You will sit with my sons." David honoured his friend Jonathan by pouring out privileges upon Jonathan's son. So for that son now to act with such treachery, you can imagine how painful it was for David to hear that from Ziba. You can imagine the moment that said, the sinking, dark feeling within him. And added to that, surely, would be the fact it would be made more painful with that question in David's mind that would be, why is he not like his father? David at that moment surely remembered Jonathan, ever loyal, ever true, so faithful to David. David's memories of him are all good, the finest man he ever knew, the finest person he ever knew. And David probably felt something of that feeling we can have, of disappointment. Why is the son not like the father? It's tremendously disappointing, isn't it, when someone doesn't live up to the expectations that we have of them. We build in our minds a sense, this person will be like this, be like that. Especially maybe within a family. He'll be like his father. And David gets hit by this. He's not at all. He seems to be the very opposite. So Mephibosheth's apparent disloyalty was like a painful knife into David's side, a dagger thrust into him. And we can understand, therefore, why he reacts as strongly as he does. Why he says, to him, "All that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours." And yet, when we read it now, in a colder light of day, wouldn't we have expected an experienced leader like David to have shown a little bit more wisdom about it, to have questioned Ziba first, to go into the story with some more detail, to ask him some direct questions? After all, Ziba potentially has a lot to gain by blackening his master's reputation. And is it really very likely that a son of Jonathan would treat David so badly when he's done so much for him? What I want you to see is this: how dark David's own frame of mind must have been. How trapped in a sad place he must have felt. Everything seems bleak at the moment. After Absalom has acted so appallingly against him, David can believe anything of anyone. And we can reach those points in life, can't we, where scepticism about the motives of others becomes so strong because somebody has really let us down so badly. And even after some great acts of loyalty that David's experienced, he still feels that pain. He's sceptical about others. He just believes what Ziba tells him. And then, of course, in his mind, as we said earlier, there's always that thought that he's caused this trouble himself. He's the adulterer, he's the murderer, he's the source of this whole mess and agony. And maybe in the light of that, he says to himself, well, if I can behave that way, Mephibosheth could easily behave in the way I'm being told. If I can be so disloyal to one of my soldiers, then is it a surprise that he can be disloyal to me? So in this fast-moving, this panic-driven situation where David is making all sorts of decisions on the hoof, in the midst of this evacuation from the city, when he's taking reports from all sorts of people and deciding what to do next, he takes Ziba at his word and he strips Mephibosheth of his property rights. A passage like that, a story like that, is a warning to us, isn't it? It's a warning to be careful. We have to be careful about decisions we take. David is distressed and worried. David has got multiple things happening at once all around him. David is having to make big strategic decisions for his army and to protect his people. David is under huge stress and he's living with uncertainty. And David is conscience-stricken about his own conduct. And when you're in such times of crisis, it's very unwise to take any decisions that don't need to be taken. And this was a decision that didn't need to be taken, wasn't it? Even if Ziba is telling the truth, and later Mephibosheth will actually challenge the story, but even if Ziba is telling the truth, does David need to do anything about it right now? Does he need to make a decision? None of it's going to be implemented. Ziba can't run off and order Mephibosheth off his property. He'd have to wait till David's back in power, till David's back on the throne. There's nothing David needed to do at this moment. Wouldn't David have been far wiser saying to this servant, "Okay, I've heard your accusation, Ziba. And it's really worrying if that's the case. It hurts me to think Mephibosheth would do that. But there's nothing to be done about it now. We'll hold an investigation when I get back to Jerusalem." And that would be wiser, wouldn't it? Not only for David's sake, but just out of fairness, out of justice for Mephibosheth. He's got no capacity to defend himself. David is going on one witness's words. And he shouldn't be, because there are extenuating circumstances, maybe. Again, I say, this incident reminds us of the importance of being patient in our decisions, of holding our tongues. There are situations which arise which seem to press us for a decision. Sometimes we're pressed for decisions by other people. People who say to us, "You've got to do something about this now, it can't wait." Sometimes we're pressed for decisions by the distress in our own feelings, a sense that everything's going wrong and we just want to sort it all out. We want a way out of the darkness. Sometimes we're pressed for decisions by the stress in our minds. Everything's swirling around and we're reacting to everything that's coming at us because life is hectic and we just want to get things done. Well, a desire to get things done is fine. But making important decisions in a rush about others isn't a good idea. And making them in a rush when they don't need to be made is a very bad idea. If you can wait, then do. If David had just waited, reflect upon the events you're confronted with, and maybe things will seem different tomorrow, or when you can find out more information. But then at that point, we need to go back to 2 Samuel and see the next stage in this story in chapter 16. You see, in this chapter, David is haunted by two ghosts of the past. On the one hand, he has this trouble with Jonathan's son, or apparent trouble. But he also has fresh trouble with King Saul. Of course, it's not Saul himself. Saul is long dead. But the spectre of those days, when David was being accused of conspiracy, accused of aggression towards the king, comes back against him now in the form of a man called Shimei. Shimei is a fairly powerful member of Saul's extended family. I don't know, maybe he even had thoughts that the throne should have come to him, but we aren't told that. But what we are told is this: that he had a big chip on his shoulder about David. Like Saul had done, Shimei blamed David for the fall of the previous king and the loss of the throne. The truth was, of course, that God had stripped away the throne from Saul because Saul had been unwilling to obey God as requested. Saul brought trouble and loss upon his own head. But Shimei repeats the old, old lie that David did it. David contrived to oppose Saul, kill Jonathan, take the throne for himself. And so as David and his men pass through a valley, trying to escape Absalom. Shimei is there shouting at them. He's delighted to see David in trouble, and to him it just vindicates all his beliefs about David. David is being punished for what he did to Saul, says Shimei. He curses David. He calls down upon him further anguish, further loss, further heartbreak. He even goes beyond that. He starts picking up stones and he pelts David with them. And he does this despite the fact that David is surrounded by his bodyguard and by his crack troops. Shimei must have had that feeling of Saul about him, that sense of madness and persecution complex that haunted Saul in his final years as king. Who in their right mind would look to upset somebody like David when the men who are with him could strike you down on the spot? In fact, one of David's cousins, Abishai, actually offers to go over and do the job. Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and cut off his head. Shimei seems to be careless of his own safety. He just sees David and his blood boils over. Like Saul, who threw spears at David in the palace when all David was doing was playing the harp. So Shimei stones David and his men as though they were already convicted regicides, murderers of the king. And Shimei sprays them with dirt when all David is trying to do is move his people to safety. Now, once again, there is pressure on David to react to this. This time it comes from a third party. As we just read out, Abishai says to him, "Okay, let me go. Let's finish this now with this chap. Let me cut off his head." But this time David restrains himself, as he did so many times with Saul. Now, part of the reason may simply be because it's Abishai who suggests cutting off his head. Abishai and his brother Joab were both important people in Israel. They had leading roles in the military, they were influential at a national level, they were related to the king by family, they were his cousins, and they were loyal to him, they supported him as king. And if you read back, you find that in fact Abishai was to be found at David's side on some of the very tense and dangerous missions that they were engaged in. And yet, Abishai, Joab, they rubbed David up the wrong way. And their crimes made him angry, although he couldn't actually punish them, because they were violent men. They were cruel men. And violence was their solution to any situation. Given an enemy, Abishai's answer was run him through, chop off his head. He suggested that to David when they stood over the sleeping King Saul in the middle of his camp. God had made a way for them to get right to the middle of the camp, and there was Saul on the ground. And Abishai was all in favour of running him through with the spear. And David said no. And Abishai now suggests it for Shimei, the relative of Saul. And you can hear David's answer again, can't you? Ringing back from the past almost. You can hear the irritation in his voice. What do you and I have in common? You sons of Zeruiah. So maybe that in part is what kept Shimei safe, David's relationship with Abishai. But there's more to it than that. David's mind is full of all the things we talked about earlier. And David is no longer sure what's true and what isn't. You can see that in his answer as well to Abishai. If he's cursing because the Lord said to him, "Curse David," who can ask, "Why do you do this?" And then in the next verse, David says to his officials, "My son, who is of my own flesh, is trying to take my life. How much more then this Benjamite? Leave him alone. Let him curse, for the Lord has told him to." Shimei's accusation against David is wrong. Shimei isn't stood there saying, "You've let us all down as king because you've had this affair with Bathsheba. You've killed Uriah." Shimei is there saying that David treated the house of Saul badly, and he's wrong. He's saying that David usurped the throne, and he's wrong. David didn't do that. He never treated Saul badly. Jonathan was his closest ally. He didn't kill in order to become king. The accusation is simply a very nasty slander based on a pack of lies. But David is walking in a very dark place in his heart and mind. And as he tries to look back on those days when he was young, in the time of Saul, he isn't sure anymore how he remembers it. Maybe the Lord has told Shimei to come and curse him. If his own son can turn against him, Absalom, then how much more people who think they've got a real grievance? Maybe Shimei is into speaking the truth in some way. Maybe it's right. Maybe God's told him to curse him. Our mood colours everything around it, doesn't it? When we're feeling that the world has turned against us, then everything has the same tinge to it, the same sense. Situations which we previously thought of as fairly clear and straightforward suddenly become confused in our minds. And of course, our memories of the past change. As circumstances get more remote, we forget what actually happened, what we actually said, what we actually did. Things fade in our minds, and as a result, we become less sure. And maybe that's what's happening to David. Everything seems so grim for him that he thinks to himself, is Shimei right? Is God cursing me? Did I do that to Saul? In some situations, it might be a good thing sometimes that we reflect on the past and change our view on it. Maybe things weren't as black and white as once we thought. But in other situations, it can become a real source of pain and worry as we start to wonder about what actually happened back there. And that's then emphasised when the past comes back to trouble us, as it does now for David, as somebody from Saul's house reappears to make the challenge once again. Satan knows this about human beings. He knows the way our feeble minds work. So he's always happy to exploit it. Years may go by and then he churns something back up from our past. Just at a time when we're so busy with everything else that we could really do without it. But that unclear, distant event comes back into the present and it can be terribly painful. It was so for David. Shimei's curses really hit home. He couldn't shake it off. But in that afflicted state of mind, David does this time do the right thing. He goes to God for vindication. He doesn't let Abishai go over with the sword. He doesn't say, oh, you're right, Abishai, deal with it. He doesn't react the way he did with Mephibosheth. He goes to God in his distress. And that's the right place for a believer to go to in circumstances like this. We always remember not only the example of David, but the example of our Lord Jesus Christ himself. When Jesus was on the cross, at that moment of his greatest torment, to whom did he go? My God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus could see nothing else in his life at that moment. It was dreadfully dark, unimaginably dark. But still, even there, he clung on to God. Because nobody else could offer any hope. To God he went. And David does the same. He says, it may be that the Lord will see my distress and repay me with good for the cursing that I'm receiving today. And that is the hope of all believers, isn't it? We go to the Lord when we are in distress, when we are in pain. We go to him, not away from him. David could have said, the Lord has told him to curse me, so I give up hope. What is the use of anything? Jesus on the cross could have said the same. God has cursed me. What hope is there? Where can I go from here? But neither took that attitude. Even at that moment of cursing, both David and Jesus went to God. Only the God of truth can bring about the right outcome And that's where we must go if we're believers. God is our only hope in time of trouble. Has the past risen up before you to cause you pain and upset? You go to the Lord, not away from him. Have circumstances become so busy and intense like David that everything's being overshadowed by it? Then you go to your Lord, not away from him. Who else can help you? Who else can you trust? Let's think of a young man who becomes a Christian as a teenager. And his family aren't Christians at all, and they find this new religious phase very strange. They disapprove of his new lifestyle. They don't like his going on about Jesus and the gospel. And then something happens in the family. They arrange a party. It's to celebrate his brother's 18th birthday. They're going to go out. They're going to go out on a Sunday evening. They're going to go to a large pub, and it's got a nightclub attached to it. Everyone's going to have a meal together from the family, and some in the family are going to move on to the club itself afterwards, whilst the older members stay drinking at the bar. As far as everyone in the family is concerned, it's just a good night out. And this young Christian finds himself in a dilemma. He knows that the atmosphere at that party will become increasingly overshadowed by drunkenness. He knows what some of them are going to be smoking when they're in the nightclub. He knows what sort of dancing will be taking place by the time midnight strikes. And as a Christian, he doesn't want to be a part of that. Once, he would have happily have joined in. But now, he doesn't like it. He doesn't want it. He finds it shameful what could happen. He can't see himself honouring God while standing in the midst of all of that. He knows what it will mean to him personally. He knows he'll be tempted to improper thoughts. He knows he's going to have to listen to immoral jokes. He knows that God's name is going to be taken over and over again in blasphemy. And he knows he's going to be under pressure to join in. There'll be some lonely girl there that evening, and one of her girlfriends will match them up. And everyone will be encouraging him. Just relax. Just have fun. And on top of it all, this is planned for a Sunday evening, when this lad feels he should be with his fellow Christians worshipping God. He doesn't think he's free to opt out, and especially not for this sort of event. And yet it's hard. This is his brother's 18th birthday. These things only come round once. But in the end, he says to his mum and dad, "I can't go." And there's a rotten argument about it. He's emotionally blackmailed this way and that. And he tries to explain it to them, and he tries to offer alternatives. "Look, couldn't we go out on Friday, just for a meal?" But they won't budge. And he has to stand on his principles and say, "I can't go." Years go by. The anger and the upset of that time is forgotten. His mum and dad get over it, and life moves on. This young man gets married. He settles down. He keeps in touch with his family. He works hard at remaining friendly, even though their lives are heading in two very different directions. When his first child is born, his parents are delighted, their grandparents at last, and they see him regularly. But then this man, no longer young, finds himself at a difficult stage in life. He's very busy at work. He's under a great deal of pressure. The second baby isn't sleeping well, and both his wife and himself are tense, and they're becoming moody with lack of sleep. He feels his spiritual life is suffering. Where once he was keen to be at church, it's gone. Where once he was keen to be at the prayer meeting, it's gone. Where once he was keen to pray and read the Bible himself, those things seem hard. He's struggling to walk with God because everything else is so intense. And then his mum dies. She'd been poorly for a while with cancer, but finally it became too much and her life is taken. It's just one more sadness in this Christian man's life. His mum wasn't a believer, but he misses her. His mum wasn't a believer, and he worries about what that means for her. As he walks with his brother from the grave, both of them upset, his brother turns to him and says, "You know, Mum never really got over what you did to us on my 18th birthday. The way you thought you were too good for us, that we didn't measure up. That was when the cancer started. Comment like that can devastate a believer, can't it? Like David in this story. He knows it's not true. If he thought about it, he knows he only did what was right, and he worked hard at making it up. He didn't let it overshadow his relationship with them. And he felt that that bad time in the relationship with his family had been left behind. It had gone into the past. And now suddenly it's right back here in the present. As though his brother's taken out a knife and stuck it into his side and twisted it. And it comes right at the very moment when he could least do with it. Just like David, as Shimei screamed at him from the hillside. Suddenly the past comes storming back into the present, and you can't be sure any longer what's right and what's wrong, and it just hurts to have it all brought back. He feels like screaming. He feels like punching his brother in the face. He feels like having a stand-up row. And he starts to wonder, was it true? Is that what I really did to them all those years ago? And what must that believer do? What should he say to his brother? How should he defend himself? Is God against him? Is that why life is so hard? That believer has an urgent need to do two things, doesn't he? To hold his tongue and his fist, and to go back to God. To put his trust back in his God. He doesn't need to be discussing it further with his brother at this moment, when the two of them are walking from their mother's grave. That believer needs to go to the one who knows the truth, the one who can uphold the truth, the one who is the God of truth. He needs to go back to his God. There are so many things in life which can take a Christian away from God. And when those circumstances come together, then the desire and the pressure to backslide, to give up, can be intense. But Christians are called, even in distress, to put their faith in Jesus Christ. We are called to trust the Son of God, to place our lives in his hands. And the simple question for you tonight is this: do you believe that or not? And if you do, then don't let anything stop you from going to him. Don't let any circumstances stop you from going to your God and say, won't you sort this? Won't you come and help me? In time of difficulty, learn from David, Abishai and Mephibosheth. In time of difficulty, don't give up on God. Recognize that in those circumstances, the most painful of circumstances, God is calling to you again to trust him. And remain faithful to him.